Blog Talk Radio.
Smart Sound.
Hello and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B with his entourage is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Well, real good, Don. At a time of a lot of news going on, and I understand we have a guest with us who will help clarify what some are saying is nothing more than fake news, an error of investigation, and et cetera. But it looks like we'll get all that cleared up. So I'll leave it in your hands, Mr. Allen. I have a couple questions at the end. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'd like to welcome Mr. Jake Johnston, with a T, from the Center for Economic and Policy Research out of Washington, D.C. And I want to explain to our listeners, Mr. Edward and Mr. Johnston, why this sparked so much interest to have you on. There was a series of stories that Mr. Johnston did about the relief in Haiti, the building of homes. One of the housing disaster relief became a disaster of its own in 2014. And in 2015, Haiti. Second, a U.S. aid contractor suspended following the housing debacle. And the third one, how the U.S. plan to build houses for displaced Haitians became an epic boondoggle. So those are three stories that mention what we're going to talk about. And you can find those on rblacknews.com if you're interested. Again, that's rblacknews.com, where I've also posted a video of Mr. Jake Johnston discussing the situation in Haiti and its future. So I'd like to welcome to the air with us on Blog Talk Radio, the Ron and Don Show, Mr. Jake Johnston. How are you, sir?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for, getting back with me. And it's always a slingshot with a rock in the dark when you call the big shots to see if they'll be on your little radio show with you. But we appreciate you coming on board tonight. So I guess my first question is, what was the genesis for you to write this story, and the organization that you work with, what do they do? If you could just kind of fill our listeners in on that, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, sure thing. Well, I guess this really starts with the devastating earthquake that struck Haiti in January 2010, left more than 250,000 dead, more than 1 million homeless. And the organization I work for, Center for Economic and Policy Research, we knew there was going to be a lot of money coming into Haiti. We knew there was going to be a lot of plans, a lot of outsiders trying to get a piece of that and being involved with that, and realized that there was going to, a real need for sort of a watchdog or some efforts to provide oversight to everything that was going to happen. And we started a small blog there just about a month after the earthquake in February 2010, and I've continued to run that since then and through today. And so this housing project, which we will eventually, I guess, get into more detail on, was one of the sort of biggest U.S. government projects post-earthquake in Haiti. And so that's sort of what piqued my interest initially with it, and what the organization's been doing to sort of keep track of things over the years.
Okay. With that said, now, one of the stories that you have, it mentioned a local company here called Thor Construction, and we want to get right into this. Can you explain what happened, the money involved, and why was it so silent? I don't know if you can answer that, but here locally, I just accidentally stumbled upon it when I was looking at some stuff for construction in Haiti and things like that, but it was a virtual silence here in the Twin Cities news, mainstream media. How did that come about? Can you explain that piece so that we understand what was supposed to be done, the money involved? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, obviously, as I said, the earthquake left more than 1 million homeless. And so getting a roof over their head became sort of priority number one. And the U.S. came up with this plan to build houses. And the initial plan was to build them around Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti. That's where most of the displaced people were. And due to some political considerations, most of the houses ended up being built up in the north, which was right down the street from a new industrial park that these donors planned to build, where workers would earn a little bit more than minimum wage and stitch T-shirts for Walmart. And the initial contract to build those houses up there in the north of Haiti, so far away from this earthquake, went to two companies, two U.S. companies. One was Thor Construction. They got around $18 million. And the other one was SEPCO, which is based out of Maryland. And they got around $13 million. And their role was to do some of the sewage and sanitation work, and also to provide construction management for the houses and Thor's building of the houses themselves. And that happened, that contract was awarded in April 2012. So, you know, all told, with these two contractors, we're talking around a $30 million project to build 750 houses. And sort of that was the idea, that was the initial project. And, you know, things went south pretty quickly. You know, it took a lot longer to build these houses than anticipated. The cost began to rise. When they were eventually finished, it became clear pretty quickly that something was wrong. The roofs weren't properly attached. The shutters on the windows were coming off. The sanitation systems, the sewage systems, were backing up and flooding the houses. And so this sort of, you know, is when I started paying attention and really sort of digging into this and trying to figure out, you know, what really happened with these houses.
Okay, and with that said, so there was additional funds beside the $18 million for construction. And what was that ballpark final amount?
Well, so that's the total amount that Thor got. Thor got a total $18 million. This other company, SEEPCO, 13. And that is a little bit higher than initially was supposed to be, you know, as I said, with these delays and a few overruns. But in 2014, sort of after the houses had been finished, and it was clear that there was, you know, these structural issues with the houses and the flooding and whatnot, USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which was funding the project, ended up giving a contract to a different U.S. company called Tetra Tech and asked them to perform an analysis of these houses, what was wrong. Now, I obtained one of their documents that's not public, but sort of got a hold of that. It detailed 29 instances of material substitution, field design changes, lack of quality assurance and quality control, and a lack of quality workmanship. And so that sort of began the process of, okay, where do we go from here? And at that point, Thor and SEEPCO, the two initial contractors, were basically pushed out and sort of moved to the side. And it was new companies that had been brought in to sort of figure out what was wrong and perform the remediation work that's been necessary over the last couple of years.
Okay, and with that said, if anyone wants to visit and look at, there's a picture on this website, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and the story is the second USAID contractor suspended following housing debacle. Mr. Edwards, I'm going to pass it to you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Johnston, for taking the time to communicate with us and allow us to ask some questions on the sector. Let me go in this direction right off the bat. In a situation such as this, where there is certainly a possibility of malfeasance, non-performance, and et cetera, particularly on a government project in another country, you can usually expect that nation, in this case Haiti, would initiate a request or even a demand for corrective action. What has been the position of the Haitian government as it pertains to this entire fiasco?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think it sort of really gets to a broader point, which is that, you know, Haiti does have quite weak governance. It's been that way for a long time, and it is perpetuated by the fact that international organizations are often the ones that are brought in to do the work. So when the U.S. government funds these housing projects, they didn't hire local companies or go to local companies or the Haitian government. They went to U.S. contractors, and that does provide a, you know, a break in sort of the chain of accountability, right? Those companies are accountable to the U.S. government, not to the Haitian government. And so it's been the U.S. government, to the extent that there has been any accountability or oversight of this, that has been provided, not from the Haitian government.
There is, of course, a deputy or maybe a couple of deputy administrators for the USDA. Our research shows that there was testimony before a select committee of the United States Congress, primarily the House of Representatives. Can you enlighten us a tad on what began to happen when the USDA began to conduct, advance, and initiate an examination of what happened?
Yeah, so I think, you know, again, there was an inspector general report that came out that identified some problems. There was this this other document that I got a hold of detailing these all of these problems. Again, these weren't public things, right? And so while USAID and the administrator who you're referring to, I believe Beth Hogan, acknowledged some delays, some cost overruns, the overall picture they painted was still quite rosy. Still say, okay, this is, you know, it's a little bit more expensive, it's a little bit longer, but this is a normal process, you know, things are okay. But underneath the surface, things were looking quite differently. And I obtained a report from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers through the Freedom of Information Act. And I'll just quote a little bit from that here. Constructed with significant variances from the contract plans and specifications. These variances could result in major damage from hurricane or seismic event and excessive maintenance requirements if left uncorrected. I think this is a really important point. One thing the U.S. government was touting, and obviously this coming in the wake of a devastating earthquake, was the structural integrity of these homes and their ability to withstand natural disasters. And in fact, what had happened was that they used substandard concrete to build the homes. And obviously that has significant ramifications for the structural integrity of the house.
It's been since 2010 that this began, if you will. Is there any information on who introduced our poor construction to first USDA and then the USDA vouched, quote-unquote, for the competency of poor construction? Was there a process in which poor construction, an American company chartered in the state of Minnesota, was awarded the $18 million contract? Did they have any godfathers?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's still probably much of this story that hasn't been told and, you know, waiting for those to speak up. I mean, I think it certainly seems like it was a new sort of work for Thor. I don't believe they had any previous operations in Haiti. And in fact, one of the things, you know, Richard Copeland, the founder of Thor, has pointed to was, you know, we as Thor, just hired a Haitian subcontractor to do the work, and they hired VNF, which is one of the largest construction companies in Haiti. You know, I mean, my initial reaction would be like, well, you know, why are we giving money to an American company to hire a Haitian company? Why don't we just hire a Haitian company to do the work? But I think, you know, there are so many layers to all of these contracting procedures, and certainly when you're talking about working internationally. And I think, you know, as much as, you know, you can sort of put blame on the contractors themselves and whatever actions they took to try and do this, the sort of ultimate responsibility is on the U.S. government that awarded these contracts and, frankly, fell down on the job providing the oversight necessary to ensure that these contractors were doing their jobs. Right? I mean, it's really, you know, it's our taxpayer dollars, and it's those people on the ground who are supposed to be overseeing it who are ultimately responsible for what that end product looks like.
Let us go back now to Ms. Hogan, a deputy or assistant administrator. It's now 2014, going into 2015. Congress is at least being on the record, on the congressional record, is being familiarized, if you will, reported to, being made to have a better understanding of what happened on this, you know, project in a small, impoverished nation called Haiti. What has the United States government, the USDA, done to recapture, if any, the dollars that certainly were inappropriately used for the facilitation and the building of this particular project? Has the United States government given any notification to poor construction that there should be a repayment of the $18 million?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And just to give some idea of the money we're talking about here, it's not just the $18 million that went to Thor, the $13 million that went to SEEPCO, but also the money that went to the contractor to do the studies that had to figure out what was wrong with them. And now the contractor that has been hired to come in and make all of those fixes. And those additional costs on top of what Thor and SEEPCO initially paid was $21 million, right? So these initial mistakes cost the U.S. government $21 million. And so I think, you know, the question of who is being held accountable and sort of what is being done to address that is an excellent one, and one that I think many people are still looking for answers for. A few years ago, it did appear as though the U.S. was preparing or, you know, threatening at least a lawsuit against Thor and SEEPCO of some nature. but it doesn't seem as though anything has gone forward in that regard, and certainly my inquiries as to the status of that have not been responded to adequately. I will say both CEPCO and Thor were suspended from receiving government contracts in 2015. That suspension lasted 2 years. And so while the remediation to the houses is, in fact, ongoing today, CEPCO and Thor are free to receive U.S. government funds once again currently. Now, from what I know, Thor has not registered to receive government contracts at this point. I don't believe they are. But they would be. That suspension has been lifted, and there is no ongoing legal case, at least publicly. And so I think, you know, it does leave this big question of, you know, why didn't the U.S. government do more to try and, you know, recoup over $20 million that was wasted?
Absolutely. Again, not to be redundant, but I feel it imperative to ask this question again, if you will, though you certainly satisfactorily asked it, but I want to ask it again. Based on our knowledge and understanding and familiarity with Mr. Copeland and his associates at Poor Construction, there has been no action by the federal government to require at least some payment, if you will. Nor has, as I understand it, based on the narrative that you just laid out and you've taken the time to lay out, there is no good faith, which is a overused word, but there's been no good faith effort by Thor, who, by the way, is or was involved in the construction of the new professional football stadium in Las Vegas. Has Thor made any offer to do anything to correct and do some, you know, I hate to say it like this, but to do some penance?
Yeah, well, I certainly nothing publicly to my knowledge. You know, when this first came out and this was happening back in 2015, Richard Copeland was quite defensive over the work that Thor had done. It would be unfair to the product, is what he said at the time. I mean, I think the evidence that's come out since then and pretty quickly after that contradicts that. But again, there's been no public effort or no public, excuse me, effort from the U.S. government to try and sort of recoup that or in a more serious way hold those responsible accountable.
I had asked you, sir, a specific question, and actually it was not unjust, about did Thor, in fact, have a godfather, if you will, within the United States Congress. And I know because you are affiliated with an entity that has to be concerned about any defamatory statements, et cetera. But we had heard here, particularly after Mr. Allen discovered your excellent work in 2015 and your reports, that there may have been a congressman here from the state of Minnesota who actually was the person that kind of vouched and introduced Thor as a reputable firm and introduced them as a reputable firm to both the USDA and even the Haitian government, who, of course, was looking at an opportunity to recover from a devastating natural disaster and et cetera. Again, I'll ask that question. Was there any kind of godfather for Thor Construction within the Congress of the United States?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not really something I can speak to or something that I've come across in my investigation. I mean, I will say that the fact that these houses were being built in the north of Haiti and not in Port-au-Prince or the capital, which was devastated from this earthquake, was a political decision led predominantly by the State Department. You know, and I think there was some politics behind that decision. But, you know, I believe in the case of Thor Construction, that was a competed contract. It wasn't a no-bid contract. Same thing with CEPCO. So there was a competitive bidding process there. But, you know, so I'm not going to be able to say more about that process or, you know, who on the inside was trying to pull strings or not. But, you know, again, I mean, I think the important part is what the people of Haiti are left with now, and what the U.S. government can do to try and hold those responsible for these mistakes accountable.
Do this as we begin to wrap, because we appreciate the importance of your time. What is the situation at this very moment as we speak here? The the those Haitians who were displaced, those Haitians who anticipated. And by the way, what was the actual number of homes that were going to be built? Is it now 2,600 or what was it initially, and what is it now?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, the initial goal was from the U.S. government to build 15,000 homes. That was reduced to, as you said, 2,600. In the end, they built around 900, maybe 1,000 at this point, most of which were these 750 houses that Thor initially built up in the north. You know, those homes, I was actually there just a few months ago. The remediation work is ongoing. They're reinforcing the walls. They've dug some canals to help with the sewage backup and drainage issues. You know, so life in that area is sort of getting a little bit better in terms of those houses. But again, I mean, you think about when this was first started and how late it is now. And we're talking about 6 years to build 750, basically one-room houses. That cost, you know, initially was going to be somewhere around $25 million. And, you know, all said and done is going to be well over $50 million to build these homes.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's quite a shocking amount for what, you know, is visible on the ground.
Right. Sir, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for taking time to be the person who did the investigation in a city in which people have said, primarily to my associate, Mr. Allen, that it was something that happened a long time ago, and it's no longer relevant, and consequently the reason that I asked you the last series of questions about the importance of humanity, compassion, integrity, and honesty, which seems to be lacking here in many respects. So I want to thank you personally for taking the time to clarify for us. Mr. Allen?
Yeah, and Mr. Johnson, I'd like to thank you also personally, and we'd like to have you back on the air. If anything should pop up on your radar that we should be alert, you know, just drop me an email or a call, and we'd love to have you back on the air, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Take care. Bye-bye. We were just listening to Jake Johnson with the Center for Economic and Policy Research talking about the construction in Haiti, the building the new houses and suspended contractors and the mess that still goes on today in that nation. Again, thank you. Wow, that's a lot, Mr. Edwards. That's a lot.
Oh, tremendous amount, Mr. Allen, and congratulations to you and to your research group. That discovered this information, because since we brought this forward, I've been amazed at the whispering that I've heard going on, that we just made this up, it never happened, the report didn't exist, the information didn't exist, the damage, if you will, didn't exist, the hardship imposed upon the Haitian people who initially thought they were going to get 15,000 housing units of quality, if you will, after the devastating natural disaster of the earthquake, hurricanes, and et cetera. And lo and behold, and by the way, let's get my phone number out. The lines are open. We may have some defenders of Thor that may want to call and dispute. So we were a little remiss. So if we could get that phone number out, Mr. Allen, anyone that may want to call us and ask us any questions. This has been quite an eye-opener, to say the least.
Yeah, I have to agree with that 100%. That number is 347-426-3904. Again, that call-in number, the lines are open, is 347-426-3904. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Hey, Mr. Edwards, something I wanted to get to. We'll be going an hour tonight, by the way, but I read this article. It was released March 13th. The 2020 census will ask black people about their exact origins. And the article is on NPR. You can actually listen to the interview. It's on All Things Considered on NPR. And the Bureau has not responded to even NPR's questions about why it's making this change to both the black category and the white category. But it will also include a new write-in area for origins. So I'm thinking, Mr. Edwards, will be real fun to say that, oh, your origin, you're from Italy or Mexico or somewhere like that. you know?
Well, because of the names that we carry as the sons and daughters of the African, I'm quite sure now that we can lay claim, particularly if we can find any semblance of our heritage and lineage and et cetera, that we can now declare ourselves. Example, when you talk in terms of my last name, if you will, the history, my ancestral history in Andersonville, South Carolina, 1792, if you will, and et cetera, I can declare myself to be of British origin, right?
Yeah. Robert, oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Edward,
absolutely.
Will. And with the S added to Edward to make it Edwards, if you will, you clearly would be of the British ethnic group, probably more Scotch than I, who would be clearly English all the way, and et cetera. And so now if we talk in terms of how we arrived here, you know, we would need to be able to have access and millions of dollars to do additional research to find out what slave ship we came over on, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what slave market we were sold at, if you will. Because here's the thing. As a British citizen, if you will, I would then have the right to file a right of claim, a right of action to acquire the cost of the damage, if you will. And we're so much into talking about mental health problems and et cetera. You know, I would maintain that, the being taken from the glory of Mother England, if you will, from the breast, you know, of the queen or the king, if you will, to these dark slave quarters, or if we were real unlucky, dumped into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean to drown and et cetera, I wonder what, under tort law, I wonder what claim and right of claim the yous and I's and others would have, okay? You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we didn't select these names. These names were selected for us, but in these names being selected for us were taken from, quote-unquote, nations, kingdoms, and et cetera, and we should have a right of ancestral claim. And so I just throw that out there, Ms. Taylor. So I would be looking, you know, this goes even beyond reparation. I'd be looking for just myself and my own history, if you will, going back to here in the United States of America, 1792. I'd be looking at anywhere from $125 million to $500
million. Yeah,
because
yeah,
that concept that I was, that we, you and I and others were properties, that's not true. We are clearly citizens of the great European families of England and France and the Netherlands and Spain. You know what I'm saying, Don?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
we're going to have to get that. We're going to get that money. Yep.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Reparations.
Yeah.
Reparations. You know, the white
yeah,
folks
exactly.
got to stop talking about that. It was a big discussion piece a decade ago, reparations. I think we
yeah.
need to reengage it, particularly with what the Census Bureau and the Department of Justice have decided to do. Then we just really need to get down to the nitty gritty. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. I agree 100%. So I'm actually scanning. Our number here again is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904, and the phone lines are open. And if you'd like, give us a call.
Well, let's do this, then, that we don't have anyone yet. I will want to do us an update on the Terrence Franklin situation, but I think in deference and respect to the researcher who spent the time clarifying for us and providing information which has now been certified and authenticated, do you think there was any, you know, kind of ripping off of the money, the initial $18 million / $31 million, I mean, and then, you know, I mean, you think people kind of put the money in their pocket, or what do you think happened, Don? Because some of this ties into the money that never was, you know, activated. I use that word for our beloved Black History Museum. You remember that, don't you? Black History Museum?
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember that like it was just yesterday.
Yeah, because Thor Construction technically was very much tied in with that, and that was $3 million that, you know, kind of left, went to Vegas. And we don't have a history museum, which means we really have difficulty talking about history. And by the way, I just came from a meeting which turned into a almost battle royal at the Minneapolis Public Schools, the Minneapolis City Council. And maybe we'll, you know, get some of our old listeners there who always like to call and talk in. The Public Safety Committee met, the mayor and the chief were there, and boy, it got pretty emotional in there, Mr. Allen, talking about public safety, 100 new police officers, how to handle crime and public safety in the communities of color and et cetera. And I have to say there were some powerful voices that emerged, and sometimes the conversations became very emotional and very heated and et cetera. I hope, by the way, Channel 5 will probably give the most extensive coverage, because they had a full crew there. They had their satellite truck, they had their cars, and et cetera, and they did a lot of covering, and there was a kind of debriefing involving the chief and Mayor Jacob Frey. By the way, Nakima Levy-Pounds kind of lit folks up in there as she talked in terms that there was a misrepresentation. Now, this is not our statement, Don. This cannot be laid to Don and Ron, as some have attempted to accuse us in the case of Haiti. But she raised some very serious questions about misrepresentation of intent by the Minneapolis City Council and Public Safety Committee on the purpose of the meeting at the Minneapolis School Board District this evening. And I would say, Donald, that there were certainly close to 100 people there. In fact, at one point, there were people standing along the walls and et cetera. So I just want to put that out there, if you know what I mean. I don't want anybody to say that we're suppressing any news, and yours truly was there for the duration. It started at 5 and ended at about 7:05. Okay? Anybody have any questions? Feel free to give this program a call. Anything else, Don? Any calls waiting in the queue or et cetera? If not, what's our next agenda item?
Oh, well, actually, I'm looking at the Star and Tribune, and 13 minutes ago, they just posted a story. Mayor Frey grilled about adding police force at 10th Forum. And the mayor declined to take a clear position.
Oh, there it is. There it is. Okay.
13 minutes ago. Yep, just popped up, and it's right there.
Okay.
And so they got some
pictures. In fact, one of the people that I saw there was United States Representative Keith Ellison. Of course, his son was there.
Oh.
The two councilmen from the quote-unquote north side of Minneapolis, Mr. Cunningham and the young Mr. Ellison, were there. But already the Star Tribune is going with the story. And, yes, but I hope they are fair, because the person that really raised some tough questions was Nakima Levy-Pounds.
Okay. And I don't see her name in the article just yet, but I was just scanning it. And like I said, it was up now, well, 15 minutes ago, just popped up. And so that's pretty interesting. That's timely and relevant. And so, I kind of miss going to those meetings, Mr. Edwards, and listening to that and lighting a fire, throw some gasoline on it and lighting a fire and watching the sparks just fly everywhere. But,
and they did tonight. And there'll be a second meeting, by the way. It will be on the 10th of April at Sabathany Community Center in South Minneapolis, a second meeting to take a look at public safety, you know, dealing with all kinds of problems from recruitment to dealing with drugs, opiates, you know, killings. By the way, we had a sensational, unfortunate, though there was no death at this point, though the young man was shot in the head. Right there in the middle of the street there on Lindale and West Broadway, I had about 3:30 yesterday. And I noticed they're kind of trying to keep that one low-keyed also. We are, unfortunately, already engaged in the spring offensive. A lot of shootings going on.
Oh, yeah, tons of shootings. And I was looking at North Minneapolis. Not only is that affecting, you know, the community cohesion, but if you look at the real estate for sale over there, Mr. Edwards, there are some beautiful houses in North Minneapolis for sale, but you'd have to stay in your house to where they're low, like 15th and Queen, 14th and Washburn, and areas like that by the Theodore Worth course over there and the sliding and skiing area.
Yes, all that area.
And I'm looking at this stuff, and actually my wife and I took a ride over there just looking. And I just said, you know what? I think it would be too stressful to worry about your kids playing out in the front yard while the three doors down. There's obviously some surreptitious activity going on that shouldn't be going on.
Out front, in the open. I hate to concur, but you're absolutely correct, if you will. And we're having shootings on a nightly basis. Oh, by the way, on that particular note, I'd be remiss if I did not do it, because we reported it on our television program to be aired on Sunday on MTN. The Washington Post 2 days ago issued a report indicating since the 1st of January of this year, there have been 244 individuals shot by the police, but a significant more than majority of those being African-Americans and others of color. 244. That's, by the way, mathematically, Don, that's 3 a day. In fact, the last one was just 2 days ago, a young African-American, mental problem, standing in the middle of the street, unfortunately with his pants down to his ankles, needing help, shot by the police, not to be confused with Sacramento, shot by the police at least 17 times. Police say they saw an object in his hand. That's become narrative nowadays.
And listen to this. You know, police in Chicago just arrested a man wearing a body armor carrying a loaded gun in the city's Union Station. They didn't shoot him, but I guess if a white man dressed in body armor carrying a full loaded weapon doesn't make an officer fear for his life as much as a black man carrying a cell phone. You know? That's crazy.
Oh, my God. Yes. And could you identify the new association carried that, so we're not accused of just making things up like some of our friends? Like at OIC, they have said it to us about, what is the name of the organization? Is it the
Chicago's very own WGN9.
They
released
it. Incredible white-owned television station. Oh, my God.
Yes. I posted that on social media, and I have black folks and white folks telling me that, well, more white people are killed by police than black men. And I'm saying that's not the point I'm trying to make. I'm saying this guy is standing in the middle of the Chicago's busiest train station with SWAT armor on, with a loaded weapon. He's 21 years old, Isaiah Malalua, and they arrest him. Now, give me body armor. Put me in the middle of a busy train station, they'll figure out a way to get a bullet in me and not hurt anybody else.
Okay? Oh, and body armor basically only goes down to just below your navel. So, I mean, we take you out with a headshot or shoot you and have you buckle and shoot you in. And there's certain areas of weakness, because most body armor, the weakness is in where your armpits are. In fact, that's how you're trained, even with a person with body armor, is that you take that. And Mr. Allen, my associate here, has been in the United States military. You take a shot for the area of the armpits and that area there, because that's vulnerable, if you will. And all depending also what kind of bullets that you're using. As you and I know, if you're using Teflon, the vest ain't going to stop the bullet. But, hey, you know, we probably shouldn't get into that because we're really emotionally, as some segments of the country, into dealing with the gun laws, if you will. Okay, okay. Phone lines open. Yeah. Apparently a lot of quietness all of a sudden after the report, the excellent report, clarification from the Washington Research Institute on the issues with poor construction and what happened in Haiti and et cetera. Let me do this at this time, Mr. Allen, because I have promised a number of people want to indicate that a conference hearing on the settlement in the matter of the death of Terrence Franklin is to take place on the 12th, if I'm not mistaken. The city of Minneapolis has indicated they want to do a settlement conference. The attorneys for the trust, Mr. Terrence Franklin, his father, Walter Franklin, have apparently declined, and I'm thinking that probably the attorney, Mike Patton, is probably in the queue. We were just reviewing again in anticipation for any questions that may come up about this. The very peculiar pieces of the petition and motions filed by Mr. Patton, which talks in terms of the manner and how in which Terrence Franklin was murdered, if you will, including being pulled into a small room there in the basement. Door was closed. Two police officers had taken him there, and they executed him in that small room. Oops. That is in the documents that have been filed with the United States Supreme Court. So they apparently are on an appeal from the Eighth Circuit. They're expecting a decision by the court, if the court will in fact hear the case. If the court does not hear the case, by the way, I would want to repeat again, then Walter Franklin II, a trustee for the estate of Terrence Farrell Franklin, will be allowed to go ahead with a trial, Mr. Allen, before the Honorable Donovan Frank of the Federal District Court for the Federal District of Minnesota. Okay?
Ooh. Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
Yeah, this is the case where it apparently, I have to tell you, Mr. Patton did a good job. Somebody of those eight or nine officers that were in the basement that day turned over on one of their buddies, and the document clearly indicates why Terrence Franklin, the deceased, his DNA was found on the barrel of the MP4 automatic, quote-unquote, submachine gun. I noticed that there's been no questions really raised, if you will, in this city since we first broke this story a couple of weeks ago. But, you know, folks, and this is to our leaders, if you will, it ain't going to go away.
No, it's not. Not at all. Not the least bit. Yeah, so, Mr. Ellis, getting back, you were talking a couple of minutes ago about the shootings happening on a regular basis in North Minneapolis. What is it, do you think, in your opinion and your expertise as a historian, what is Jacob Fry, Betsy Hodges, R.T. Ryback, because it hasn't stopped, what are they missing? What points are they missing? Are they too political? Are they just not? I mean, could you have an observation?
I don't think the sensitivity. I mean, let's be very candid. As two black men who are familiar with circumstances that exist within our community and et cetera, it's let me say it like this, Don Chief, and I know this will create some controversy, but that's what talk radio is about. I was saying to an associate in law yesterday that I wonder if we would be getting the kind of statements and et cetera that we're hearing from people if, in fact, Officer Noor would have shot a black woman. Yeah. My long experience, which goes back certainly longer than 50-some years, goes back to 1958, if you will. I am afraid that I would have to say, if you know, quizzed on that there would be nothing approaching the so-called emotional state of our beloved city if Officer Nord would have shot and killed a African American or a person of color. particularly a woman. Let's deal with that because people are talking about the emotional situation. I was on point on my television program last week. I indicated that there would be certainly a payment of at least a minimum of $5 million. The record, by the way, and this is another case that people don't like to talk about in this town, the previous largest settlement for a person who was injured or died at the hands of the police was a excellent Asian police officer by the name of Dewey No, who unfortunately, after the circumstances and the injuries that he suffered after receiving for his family a settlement of about $4.3 million, committed suicide. People don't talk about that in this town, if you will. Dewey No. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of y'all out there, particularly in law enforcement and et cetera, cringe when that is brought up. But anyways, to your specific question, one of the problems is that we just are not seen as human beings in that context. We are still seen, Mr. Allen, as property, if you will. And so the kind of energy that normally goes in when people are dealing with circumstances, conditions, problems that, you know, confront, quote unquote, other human beings. We as black people make the mistake of assuming that we are being embraced also as human beings. Now, you know, I don't need anybody white to call up screaming and hollering that they love African Americans, love Negroes, and they think of them as humans and et cetera. You and I know that that's just not true. So to your specific question, previous administrations and et cetera, do, as has been the situation ever since the first slave ship arrived, if you will, in Charleston, New York City, New Amsterdam, as they called it back then. We're talking now the 1600s. They just don't see us as people that they should be concerned about. So consequently, these activities and conditions continue to exist, which leads, quote-unquote, to actions against the health and the well-being of African-Americans and other people of color. And some of that came up in the meeting tonight. And my associate, Mr. Allen, is holding an advanced copy of what will be tomorrow morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And a lot of black folks raised real serious questions about just how serious were these authorities that met this evening at the school district headquarters for almost 2 hours. So that's kind of my take. There's even more to be said, but I guess I just don't want to be unnecessarily inflammatory. But I would challenge you, Mr. Allen, or anybody else, to tell me what the narrative would have ignored would have shot and killed a black woman.
Yeah, it would have been totally different.
Because our black woman would have been just as beautiful and just as compassionate and just as religious as any Caucasian woman, if you will. And you've not heard anyone even mention that until you just heard me say it as 6 minutes ago, have you?
Nope, not at all.
Yeah. So we're getting to run down. We got about 13 minutes left. Again, the phone lines are open. We just talked about the mindset as it pertains to the right of life for African Americans, if you will, and Native Americans and others in this city. And Mr. Allen has asked the question, why is it so difficult to get a answer? And then in the process of getting an answer, having put in place a functional series of actions, if you will, programs and et cetera. By the way, we're still waiting, and this is for our good friend Louis King and others. We're still waiting for the financial report on that, you know, $700,000 that everybody received last year. You remember to take care of downtown and to take care of North Minneapolis. Remember that money, Don? Yeah. Do you have a call coming in?
I was just checking. No, I don't have a call coming in, but I want to say the stadium they built in the backyard of North Minneapolis, and no one passed, what is that, Highway 55 back there is benefiting, except for the holiday station. You know,
and what station is this so that our people, our stadium, but that our people are clear that you're talking about?
Oh, I'm talking about the U.S. Bank Stadium in downtown Minneapolis, set back there where the old Metrodome was, and between, what is that, Chicago on the south and Washington
on
the north
side.
Yeah,
oh, well, I bet that's what some okay. Yeah, well, I'm still waiting on, and someone told me that that our good friend is no longer with the sports facility, that he now is works for the county. Have you been able to get any clarification on that?
You know what?
Vice President of Affirmative Action is no longer with the entity known as the Stadium Authority.
Yeah,
and that
would be Mr. Alex Tittle. I put in several calls and I've not gotten any word back and nothing. And if this is the case, if it turns out to be absolutely correct, this is the quietest change in jobs for a high-profile, multi-billion-dollar operation of an individual working inside of that ever in the Twin Cities, as far as I'm concerned, that I can remember. Because usually when a move like that happens, you know, at least maybe Insight News might pick it up, or Spokesman Recorder, or
right.
NPR.
Absolutely.
When you have someone of the Black American persuasion that is heavy hitting at those high levels, you know, and set some folks up pretty nice, actually. And
we're also waiting for the final count, if you will, of how much the African American community made off the Super Bowl. Mr. Allen and I, less than a month ago, said that we were hearing conversations within the right quarters, if you will, you know what that means, of in excess of $50 million, went to Black businesses and et cetera. Mr. Allen and myself asked on these programs a month ago if we could get a copy of the document, just like we're still waiting for copies of the final reports on how many African Americans worked on the stadium and how many African American businesses drew down money and et cetera. In fact, one of them would have been poor and maybe tried construction. Man, it's hard to get patient. I don't know what the problem is.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a secret. It's a G19 classified.
And I don't know why.
Secret.
I mean, it provided maximum prosperity for the Negro community, right? I mean, that's what folks have been talking about at the parties and et cetera, you know. In fact, our good friend Mr. Copeland was in the city for almost a month, leading right up to the Super Bowl. You know, you had to be a little careful this time around about how you use those suites down there at the People's Stadium. But, you know, we know that there's, you know, some frustration with us raising these questions. You know, all the folks have to do is just, you know, give us a call and identify themselves and say that they don't want to hear any more conversation about the museum, as an example, or Thor construction, or, you know, how many Blacks worked and made money on the stadiums and et cetera, and that the Black community made over $50 million according to these leaders on the Super Bowl alone, and there's nothing but prosperity. In fact, people were saying that yesterday in the middle of West Broadway in Lindale, as a young African-American man is being rushed to the hospital after being shot in the head as an outgrowth of continued violence. And by the way, we're averaging two to three shootings a night slash day here in the Twin Cities, and particularly in Minneapolis, if you will. And maybe it'll go away, Don. I'm not sure. Maybe it'll go away. I'm not sure. You know, but I just await my leaders to tell me what's going on.
Well, Mr. Edwards, we have a lot of people in the queue, but no one's crossing over to talk to us, and that's highly unusual. But whenever we have an exclusive like this, Jake Johnson from Washington, D.C., calling in, breaking it down, and we're finding out that it's all truth, you know, people kind of shy away.
Did you notice how and he did not shy away that he was boots on the ground in northern Haiti?
Oh yeah.
And that he actually began to come into to that particular area and monitor that situation starting in 2011. Did you notice how he was unbashed and that he did not equivocate, if you will?
Oh yeah. And someone just sent me a message. Someone just sent me a message, Mr. Edwards, and I have to address this because it's part of people not understanding geography.
Uh-huh.
Haiti, right next to Haiti on the same island is the Dominican Republic, a luxury resort island where they make billions of dollars a year. And Haiti is like the toilet stool of the Dominican Republic. And what shocks me is that the Dominican, the DR, is just overflowing with wealth, resorts, tourists coming in, cruise ships coming in. Yet the other side of that island where Haiti is devastated.
The west side of Pensacola.
Yeah, just devastated. And I just want to tell some people, look at a damn map. Haiti is not an island like Jamaica. Jamaica's 90 miles long, sits right under Cuba, and is usually quiet. But you go over east a couple hundred miles, well, less than 100 miles, you'll run right into the Dominican Republic and Haiti, which is on one island.
Yes, which Haiti, the island of Hispano, is right next to Cuba, if you will, as you move down the so-called chain. Towards the world. Oh, by the way, they still have not repaired anything really in Puerto Rico, and they also really not repaired anything in the Virgin Islands like they should have, which is a true paradise. In fact, one of the government officials, black female, was in the Twin Cities here a couple weeks ago, and in fact, she did an interview with Pete Rose. Black American music, if you will, and she talked in terms of people coming to the Virgin Islands. Now, that's the Virgin Islands. Now, I understand what my colleague, Mr. Allen, is saying, and I can tell by what he's holding up, is that, go get a map and understand that that Haiti is not a single island. It is a part of a much larger island divided by, quote-unquote, Haiti on the west, the Dominican Republic, if you will, on the east, if you will. And there's just a world of difference, unfortunately. And it is tragic what happened to those Haitian who as far back as 2010 were being told that 15,000 state-of-the-art homes were going to be built for them and et cetera. And as Mr. Johnston pointed out on this program tonight, the final number was like 900.
Wow.
There was nothing ever printed about it in any of the major papers in this state, if you will, and there was no discussion and et cetera. In fact, I remember hearing Gunner Gary Cunningham on a program on one of the contemporary stations just about 3 weeks ago, talk in terms of the wonderful things that that Thor Construction is doing, the jobs that they're bringing in, as well as the new elevator company that we allegedly have here on the north side. I think it's H&B Elevator Company that's allegedly on the 3,000 block of Washington Avenue North.
Mm-hmm.
I've been by there a number of times. I can't find it.
Yeah, I haven't seen. I drove down there too, Mr. Edwards, and I was looking for like maybe a 3 or 4 story kind of warehouse type building. Didn't see it.
Yes. I would hope someone can let us specifically know GPSs or something, because I'd like to go in and get some of the material. Young African American is one of the partners. He is not the majority partner, because we were able to tap in to. Certain information and websites and etc. And the majority owner of the company, Gary Cunningham, this is for you, is a Caucasian.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And with that
yeah.
said, we're down to 30 seconds. We're down to 10 seconds.
All right.
And we'd like to thank everybody right. for listening. This is.
All right. Take care. James Brown, take us home.